Mike Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kingfish lose to the Fond du Lac Dock Spiders 5-4. Those two teams meet again up in Fond du Lac tonight. Major League Ball, Brewers lose to Minnesota. Cubs are off, and the White Sox beat Houston 3-2 in 11. Tonight, the Brewers host Cincinnati at Miller Park. Cubs are in Arizona. The White Sox host Kansas City again. NFL preseason football. Packers look pretty decent, beating the Eagles last night 24-9. Now the WGTD Friday forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy and mild. Today's high 73. Right now, wind out of the north at 3. Humidity high at 96%. Pretty good cloud cover, but a nice morning all in all, 64 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath, 8:11, The Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very happy to be sitting across from Guida Brown, Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse, for part one of today's morning show. What prompted this invitation to Guida Brown, which she very kindly accepted, was an NPR report that I heard a few days ago, and I don't remember now the program, but it was a story about language and addiction and about the best way for us to talk about issues related to addiction, and in particular, how should we characterize the crisis in our country involving opioid addiction. And there's been some difference of opinion in terms of how this should be characterized. Should we call it a national emergency? Should we call it an epidemic? And so on. And there have been sort of conflicting indications from the White House, although most recently President Trump seems prepared to call this a public emergency. But I thought Guida Brown would be a great person to talk about this, to maybe sketch the basics of this current opioid addiction, what we're talking about, and then talk a little bit about the way in which we should talk about something of this scale, and also the way in which we should talk about someone who is dealing with drug abuse. Should we call them a drug addict? Should we call them someone with an addiction? And what difference does it make in terms of the way we use language on these occasions? Guida Brown, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Glad you can be here. I think the most immediate issue that would be worth talking about, and this is actually probably a topic we'll only be able to scratch the surface of today, is this crisis with opioid addiction. First of all, just very briefly, for the sake of anyone listening who doesn't quite understand what we're talking about, what do we mean when we are referring to opioids and to opioid addiction? And what is the scale of the problem? Are we seeing something that's unprecedented?
That was a lot to ask, Greg.
Yeah, right.
So opioid addiction or the problem with the opioids is it runs the full gamut from anything from a prescription drug, painkiller, to heroin. And we used to try to make a distinction, which is another problem with our language. So we used to try to make a distinction between opioids, just the prescription synthetics, and opiates, which is the heroin and the morphine. And somehow it became so convoluted because that is not there's no distinction between somebody who is addicted.
In terms of their own body.
Right. That and 4 out of 5 current heroin addicts, people who are addicted to heroin, started with opioids, with painkillers.
Wow.
Yep. And that's why it's an epidemic. That's why it's such a huge problem, because we had doctors, in part it's because doctors were overprescribing, but the other part of it is we, the consumer, go in and say, ibuprofen, that's not going to help me. I need to take an opioid. And so it was our fault as well. And people, the opioids act on your body in a specific way to make you believe you're in more pain than you are. So when the doctor says take 1 or 2 every 3 to 4 hours, stay ahead of the pain. By the end of a weekend, you're taking 2 every 3 hours because your tolerance goes up very, very fast with opioids. And again, it changes your brain to make you think you're in more pain than you are. And so people get addicted very, very easily. Hmm. Opioids on the street, if you have to go out and buy a painkiller, because, you know, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to shoot up heroin. So opioids on the street cost 5 times as much as heroin does today. And that's really what happened for us. When you and I were growing up, anyone you heard about who was using heroin was injecting it. The heroin was not as pure. It was not as accessible. It didn't come from, now it's coming from Central America instead of the Far East, and so it's much easier to get. It also looks nicer. It used to be they actually called it black tar. It was tarry looking. Now it's much more white. So, and you, because of the purity, you can snort it. So people move from opioids, the painkiller, to snorting heroin. And then once they're addicted to heroin that they're snorting, they generally will move to shooting it up, because it's a better high that lasts longer.
So it's even stronger.
Farther. Yeah.
And are we essentially talking about sort of the same medication but just drastically stronger when we talk about some of these painkillers to which you might receive a prescription versus something like heroin on the other end of this of the stream? The way you were talking about it almost made it sound like it's sort of the same drug, at least in general.
It
but
is
just
exactly the same.
Wow.
I always give this story about my father. My father died in 1987. He was alcoholic, and he was dying in the hospital with cancer, lung cancer that had moved to his brain. And my maternal aunt was in the hospital room with us, and she said to the nurse, can you give him something for pain? He looks like he's uncomfortable. And the nurse turned and looked at us and said, you know, morphine is addictive.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so now we give out what is essentially morphine, you know, in a synthetic form. We give it out to everybody for everything. We give it to kids who are 12 years old for teeth extractions or broken bones. It just became sort of the go-to drug. And it is exactly the same as heroin or morphine in your body. It is, you know, obviously those others are stronger, which is, again, why economically people move to heroin.
Right. But
I'm sorry, fentanyl. Fentanyl is a new one on the market, generally coming from China when it's being mixed in with drugs, and that's another 10 times, 100 times more, 10 to 50 times more than heroin, and then carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer. So once the addiction starts, that trajectory is so fast and so damaging.
Wow. And so I think one of the things you're saying is it's been a mistake to speak in a sense, such distinctive terms.
Yes.
About we have these prescription painkillers over here, and then we have this thing called heroin that's over here. And in a sense, if we had been talking more accurately right from the start about the fact that this is essentially this stuff over here that you're not scared of at all, is essentially a starter kit for heroin in a sense. I mean, if it's not used carefully.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the problem with that language, we still now, people who got addicted to the prescription medication, they're perceived as somehow better than somebody who's using heroin. And the problem with that, of course, is they're both going to die without some sort of intervention. And they're absolutely no different. The money is really the economics of why are you not still using the prescription opioids is the only difference, again, out of 4 out of 5 of our people who are now addicted.
Right. And now we're seeing statistics that hundreds of people every single day are dying from overdoses related to the misuse of opioids.
Right.
What can be done when someone is caught in the grips of this kind of addiction? What, if anything, can be done?
So, treatment works. People can get off of it. One of the problems for opioid addiction is that it's so painful. The withdrawal is so very, very painful.
And you mean physically?
Physically painful. I've been told it's like having the worst flu of your life or the worst flu times 10 over the course of 2 weeks.
Mm.
The problem with that is generally it won't kill you. And so trying to get residential treatment for that is tough. And so people have to suffer through. And, you know, if you had the worst flu of your life for 2 weeks and you had the opportunity to get over the worst flu by just going back and using the same drug, hard to get off of it because of that.
So it isn't just what we typically think of when an addict is trying to break their addiction, that they just miss how good they felt.
Right.
But in the case of this, they have to weather something so intensely unpleasant, really awful, in order to get through to the other side.
Yep.
And that's asking a lot.
And then there is the whole dopamine in the brain, and they don't want to feel that way. So one of the medications that helps is medication-assisted therapy is Vivitrol. Vivitrol is an antagonist that prevents a person from getting high. So they get an injection once a month. There's a great program through PSG, Professional Services Group, and the Division of Health. But one of the studies that we were just talking to the drug rep, and one of the studies that they had done is a lot of people, once they were on Vivitrol, one of their complaints was toothaches. And what that is think about being on a painkiller all the time. You have no pain.
Mm.
And so then when you start getting off of that painkiller, things that normally would have affected you start affecting you. And people who are addicted don't generally take great care of their teeth or their bodies. Mm. And so toothache was a very common complaint from them, not because the Vivitrol did anything about the toothache, but because the use of the drugs was masking any pain.
Right. And of course, if you've gotten used to life without pain,
mm-hmm.
then even the smallest or most ordinary of pain, which the typical person tolerates without too much trouble, becomes a major issue.
That's it. I do a lot of talks with District Attorney Mike Gravely, and he talks about how his grandfather would never have dreamed of going through a life with no pain. And that's part of what happened in our healthcare system is that somewhere in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, some really sketchy research was done on these opioids, and they decided that people should be able to live pain-free. And up until that point, you know, when my father was dying in the hospital, up until that point, that was never an option. That was never even a consideration because it's kind of ridiculous.
Right. I mean, it's just part of what it means to be a human being
is
to endure some pain.
Right.
So how would you characterize the scale of the problem that we are seeing, for instance, right here in Kenosha County where you work? And is this more serious than anything that you have seen through the course of your career? Or would that be an exaggeration?
No, it would not be an exaggeration. But when I first started in the substance abuse field, we had all the crack babies. Everyone was so afraid for the crack babies. And studies later proved that really wasn't even the concern. The bigger concern was babies who were born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, because mothers who were using crack were then having to come down and sleep, and so they would use cheap wine to drink after they used the crack, and that was really what was more affecting the babies than anything. And so that sort of fell by the wayside. And so I would say, yes, this is the most serious problem I've seen. part of my issue when, again, when we silo, so it's one thing to silo opioids and opiates. It's another thing to silo a person with a substance use disorder. So I have, you know, so many anecdotes of people who, if you're only an alcoholic, that's not a problem. There was just a study yesterday I just saw from JAMA that 1 in 8 people is addicted to alcohol. So we have an addiction epidemic. That's, I mean, if we took away all the opioids in the world, our addiction problem is not going to go away. The issue is that opioids kill people faster. And so we've been killing people with alcohol for a thousand years. It's just a slow, horrible death. And opioids is a very fast death. And so that is much more impactful. If we counted, I mean, there's some statistic out there about how many people die from alcohol addiction every day. And it has to do with, you know, airplanes full of people. And if those were falling out of our skies, we would be saying so much more about this. And so, again, it's that suddenness, that horrific death that we're seeing from people we never dreamed had problems because of how they're getting to that point. And so we do have an epidemic. It is the worst I've seen. And again, the sudden death of people who are addicted to opioids is really quite horrific. Right. And now it's affecting everybody. It's not just affecting, you know, it's almost like we can compartmentalize those sorts of people who are dying from addictions. And now we can't compartmentalize people who are dying from opioids because it's your child. It's, you know, your brother, your cousin. It's everybody anymore.
Right. And it sounds like this isn't just New York City and Chicago and Berkeley, that this is happening in Kenosha and Racine. And I'm guessing that this is happening to some extent even in Union Grove and Bristol and, I mean, places where we don't immediately think something like this is going to be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's everywhere. I went to a training a few years back, and there's a bigger meth problem, methamphetamine, in the northern counties, but that's coming to our area as well. And so because of the corridor that we're in, from Chicago to Milwaukee, we have a humongous problem. We have a humongous problem here in Kenosha, and it's not just the city of Kenosha. It's not just the city of Racine. It really is affecting everybody.
And what age group primarily, or is it impossible to generalize?
No, it is. It's young men generally. Again, that's looking at sort of that switch from opioids to heroin. It's young men. But again, we have a lot of people who are addicted to the painkillers that their doctors are prescribing. So,
and it's very easy to go down this really terrible road. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that's been swirling around is whether or not to characterize this as a public health emergency. And evidently, the initial word from the White House was that the suggestions to call it that were going to be disregarded. And now, more recently, President Trump has seemed to indicate that he is about to announce very publicly that this, in fact, is a public health emergency. Can you just speak to this particular matter of language and what the hesitancy might be in calling this a public health emergency, if there is any reason you can think of?
My guess is an expectation of resources. There, if you label it, you have to do something about it. You know, when we have a flood emergency or those kinds of things, then somebody expects some money to fix it. And so that would be my guess. And so if we continue to kick that can down the road, it looks better for the government.
Last month, TransCanada executive Paul Miller,
things that the rest of us don't have the means to do, so they can, you know, when you use a public health model, it gets people to start talking about it. It gets people to start moving forward and gives us very specific means to address it. So I love that it's finally becoming part of the national conscience. It's a slow, slow process. And again, if we took away all the opioids in the world, people are not going to stop being addicted. And so we have to look at that as well.
The other question of language that came up recently in a report on NPR that I think I mentioned at the top as I was introducing you was a question, and I think this is actually something that had first emerged a year or two ago, but questions about how best to describe someone who is contending with this really serious problem. And evidently, Michael Botticelli, who was sort of the drug czar under President Obama, had released a paper a year or two ago called Changing the Language of Addiction. And essentially, it was a suggestion that we need to stop saying he is an alcoholic or he is an addict, he is a drug user, and we need to start crafting our language differently. So this is a person who is addicted, a person with an addiction. He is a person who uses drugs. First of all, does that sort of align with your own personal feelings on how we should be speaking about this? And for instance, at a place like the Hope Council, is this the kind of language that you are electing to use?
I'm not going to say we don't slip up, but yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't talk about my diabetic sister. My sister has diabetes. We don't talk about, you know, that cancer person. I don't even know how you'd say that. We talk about that person with cancer. And this is seriously one of my biggest buttons when we talk. It's just put the person first. So we talk about disabled people, and it makes me lose my mind. They're not disabled people. They're people with disabilities. And so they're not alcoholics. They're people with alcoholism. They're not. The problem with the language is, again, that can make them others. And if you put the person first, they're less likely to be an other. And so also the language of the language, the junkies. Junkies implies that they're bad people that we can throw away. One of my coworkers talks about she had been someplace where they were doing drug testing. And the person was talking about, well, you know, if you have a clean test, then you're fine. But if you have a dirty test, blah, blah, blah. And that, again, that language is making somebody dirty. And so we don't ever use that language. We say your test is positive or negative. That's just what is appropriate. And so we always try to put the person first. We always try to use the proper language to make sure that they're getting all of the respect that is due them. And I think when we use that other language, it changes that view.
I think the main point of this most recent story that I heard over public radio was that the use of language matters often because it tends to affect the kind of services that someone receives. That if someone is labeled a drug addict or an alcoholic, they almost certainly are going to receive more punitive treatment versus someone where they have been characterized in a little more, let's say, humane fashion, then they are more likely to receive the treatment that they need versus the punishment. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, no. So, you know, we believe that addiction is a disease. And so a disease is chronic, progressive, and lethal. No one wakes up in the morning and says, hey, I think I'd like to be a heroin addict. No one wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'd like to be an alcoholic. And so we treat those like diseases, like other diseases. And you're absolutely right. If we are using that stigmatizing language, people aren't going to get the services that they need. If we are making them, you know, when you use the word alcoholic, far too often we think of somebody who is a skid row bum, who's homeless and begging for money. Certainly when you use heroin addict, we think of somebody who's stuck in a corner injecting into their arm. So it's just really bad language to try to overcome when they do need services. As a community, as a society, it's very easy to stigmatize these folks. And we can't continue to do that because that's what got us into the position that we're in now.
Right. One thing that did strike me as interesting in this article that I read is that it basically said we shouldn't call, for instance, you know, somebody a heroin addict because that reduces them to only that. And it kind of takes away all of their humanity and it in a certain sense obliterates everything else about them, mm-hmm. and which I certainly understood. The one thing that's a little bit ironic about that is that, in fact, when one has a really serious addiction, that's in fact what happens in a sense. It is something that consumes the person. It really does tend to obliterate everything else about them. I mean, that's one of the most tragic things about it. And yet, if we use language that in a sense hastens our attitudes along that line, that just makes the problem worse and makes it, I suppose, much less likely that they're going to get the help that they need.
Yeah, so think about a person who has cancer. You know, they've been battling cancer for years. They're maybe at the end of their life. We still don't consider them just the cancer victim. I don't know. Because we don't use that language.
Right. Even if the reality is cancer is affecting every single
right.
aspect and,
right.
and preventing them from doing all the other things they would want to do, there is still something at the heart of it very demeaning about making them only a cancer victim.
Right. And so the same goes for a person who might be addicted to heroin. You know, a lot of folks, again, that trajectory is fast. They lead to horrible consequences very quickly. But the fact of the matter is some of them work. Some of them, you know, some of them are gainfully employed. And when it comes time to getting services, it comes time for them to say, you know what, this is the end of the road for me. I really want to get help. It's going to be really hard to get help when they feel that they themselves are junkies or heroin addicts or, you know, whatever that language is. And so helping them to understand that it's a disease, that they are a person with an addiction, a person with a chronic lethal progressive disease really makes a difference. It makes a difference from the service provider's perspective. It also makes a difference for them because we have a lot of people. I talk about the gaping head wound. We have a lot of people walking around with gaping head wounds of addiction that we don't address as a society because somehow, again, we've made them others. And yet if you're driving your car down the road or you're walking down the road and some guy passes you with a gaping head wound, our response, everybody's universal response is, dude, you've got a gaping head wound. Do you want me to call 911?
Right.
But we know these people living in our lives who have essentially a gaping head wound that no one will address because of the stigma in part.
Right. And language is one step towards living with that addiction, with that that stigma and maybe helping us help them and also helping these people help themselves. I mean, by reminding them also that they're first a person with this really serious problem, but a person first deserving help.
Yes.
If people want to contact the Hope Council, what do they do?
They can call us at 262-658-8166 or look at our website at hopecouncil.org, and council is C-O-U-N-C-I-L, hopecouncil.org.
Guida Brown is the executive director of the Hope Council of Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. Guida Brown, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the great work that you and all of your colleagues are doing at the Hope Council, and I'm so glad we had this conversation. Thank you so much. In part two of today's morning show, we are looking back at the life of Princess Diana. Believe it or not, it is 20 years ago that Princess Diana was killed in that tragic car accident in Paris. The National Geographic Channel on Monday is going to be airing an absolutely fascinating documentary called Diana, In Her Own Words. This is a film without narration, save for the voice of Princess Diana herself, and in a few rare instances through the course of the film, the voice of journalists at the time. But mostly, this is based on a series of private interviews recorded with Princess Diana while she was still married to Prince Charles, interviews that, with the exception of a few brief excerpts, have never before been heard by the public. I had the pleasure of speaking with Tom Jennings, the executive producer of Diana in Her Own Words, and talked about the exquisite craftsmanship with which this film was put together.
You know, it's funny. I have a print journalism background before I started doing documentary films, and someone said to me not too long ago, isn't it funny that you're making these kind of films and there's no writing in them at all? And I said, oh, you're wrong. It's all written. We just have to use other people's words, which makes it even harder. You know, in a traditional documentary that people can click on, you know, YouTube and watch, you know, it's very easy if you can't find a way to turn a story point to get from point A to point B. You just write a line and the narrator says it. Well, we don't have that luxury. You know, we have to rely on the media that was available. And so it is kind of a matrix of information from which you have to pick and choose, you know, what parts of this story are most valuable in telling the story. Do I have the media available to make it happen? And if not, do I let it go or do I try and find some way to get this in? And, you know, it's a lot of late nights, Greg. It's a lot of late nights. But in the end, as you saw with the Diana film, when it comes together and really works, there's nothing else like it. I like to think, and, you know, I rarely will say this about anything that I've done, but I think as far as this Diana film goes, I think we've done the definitive Diana story from her point of view, granted, because we had her material from which to work. But from her point of view, I don't know that it can get much closer to the truth than what we've presented in this National Geographic film.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Tom Jennings, who is the executive producer of Diana, in her own words, which will premiere Monday evening on the National Geographic Channel. And as I mentioned briefly in the interview, in a sense, the heart and soul of this documentary is a series of extraordinarily frank and revealing interviews, audio interviews, that Princess Diana recorded. Explain to our listeners when and under what circumstances these interviews were recorded.
Sure. The interviews were recorded in the spring, summer, and fall of 1991. They were recorded inside Kensington Palace. What had happened was Diana had her marriage from the start, which most people at the time did not know. Her marriage was deeply troubled. She was deeply troubled. She was having all kinds of personal problems. And she decided that she wanted to tell her story, and she didn't know how to do that. She had a good friend that she'd known since childhood, a guy named Dr. James Coulthurst. And she asked James Coulthurst, do you know any journalists who would be interested in writing a book about me? Of course, every journalist in London, if not around the world, would have wanted to write that book. And he happened to know a journalist named Andrew Morton. And, of course, Andrew Morton was more than willing to work with James and Diana to create the book that came out in 1992, which was called Diana, Her True Story. And so because Morton was well known among British journalists, it would be impossible for him to meet with Diana without someone noticing. So they devised a plan, and that plan was that Morton would write questions, and Coulthurst, who would visit Diana often because he was a friend, literally would ride his bicycle to Kensington Palace, and the guards would wave him through because they'd seen him dozens of times before. And they would find a quiet corner inside the palace, and Morton would pull out a tape recorder, and the list of questions, or excuse me, Coulthurst would do that, the list of questions from Morton, and they would have a conversation for a couple of hours. He'd put the tape back into his backpack. He'd ride off. He'd meet Andrew Morton at a cafe. He'd hand them the tape, and Morton would go off and transcribe it, and that's how the book came about. And that's what the tapes are.
How many hours of tape are we talking about? And did you and your colleagues have access to all of them?
Yes, there's about 7 hours, and we were fortunate in that we went through Andrew Morton's publisher, a very nice man named Michael O'Mara, and they eventually gave us a copy of all the tapes. It was a kind of a remarkable experience to even get them. They had no plans on they knew the 20th anniversary was coming. This was about a year and a half ago. They'd been approached by other people already in the UK, and they just felt like the tapes were so special that they didn't want them used in a way that would be less than reverential to what they are, as you know, how special they are. And it was because of the film we did on the Space Shuttle Challenger, actually, where we had no narration and no interviews. I went in talking with Andrew Morton's publisher, I said, look, you know, we do these in a very different kind of way. We do these without commentary other than from the news media at the time. And we'd like to talk with you about using the tapes and having just Diana narrate her story. And surprisingly, no one had ever asked them that before. So I sent them a copy of the Challenger film. They looked at it, and about 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to London to sit down in their offices and listen to Diana talk for 7 hours on a rainy day, drinking English tea. And by the end of it, feeling like I'd been part of history. Mm. It was remarkable. I'll never forget it.
Right. My understanding is that when this book came out by Andrew Morton called Diana, her true story, that it was not revealed to the public that this book was based on these interviews, that at the time, at least for the most part, the public had no idea that these interviews, in fact, had ever been conducted and existed.
That is correct. When the book came out, Andrew Morton and the book and the publisher, they were pilloried by many people for being a lie. Basically, they said Morton had made it all up because no one wanted to believe that the beloved Princess Diana could possibly be so unhappy that her existence, you know, that this fairy tale romance and marriage that people so desperately wanted to believe in and still do in some ways, no one wanted to believe that it could be as bad as her having bulimia, as having suicide attempts, that Charles was more interested in another woman than in her, and that had begun even before they were married. You know, there were just so many, you know, scandalous things, especially for a princess, that people didn't want to believe it. And to Morton's credit, you know, he's been people have all kinds of opinions about Andrew Morton, but I'll give him a lot of credit in that when they were the public and members of the monarchy and members of the government were just slamming him left and right, he never said that, hey, it was Diana that told me all this. He didn't reveal that source until after she died. And then he felt like, okay, well, she's not here anymore. Now I can tell the world where all this information really came from, and it came from Diana herself.
Somehow in the film, maybe on one of the, I forget what you call those, the placards, or when we see printed words on the screen, the point is made briefly, but I'm glad it's there, that this film, by its very nature, is going to present the perspective of Diana herself. That there is, in a sense, no opportunity for rebuttal from, in particular, Prince Charles, let alone anyone else in the royal family. And I wonder if you and your colleagues wrestled with the meaning of that reality very much. That is, the inherent, in a sense, unfairness of such a film. Although I hasten to add, I'm glad you made this film, and I'm glad I watched it. I hope many people will watch it. But by its very nature, it is also, at least to an extent, a one-sided story, or it presents one side of a complicated story. I wonder how much you and your colleagues talked about that, and as you chose what was going to be in this film, did you think at all about trying to give us at least a hint of perspective from the other side, from, for instance, Prince Charles's perspective on all of this?
Well, you're right on the money. That was discussed actually from day one, once we realized what we had, and how to try and be as fair as possible. But you're correct in that, you know, we have these tapes, and the tapes were the foundation of this very famous book. And to go out and start interviewing people to get, you know, the other side of the story would kind of break the magic of taking you back in time and allowing Diana to tell her story. So we were extremely aware of it, and we made choices throughout in what we decided to use from her tapes that we felt told her story, but told it in the most fair way possible. Also, early on, several times in the first hour or so of the film, we were always looking for moments where Prince Charles showed some kind of kindness towards Diana or some kind of protectiveness towards her. There's a scene where she's at a polo match a few days before they're getting married, for example. And she is having a really tough time. And she's just, you know, things are, as she explains in the film, you know, everyone's paying attention to her. She doesn't know why. And she's already aware that Charles has been seeing this other woman, Camilla Parker Bowles. And she doesn't even know if she should go through with the marriage. And so you see her kind of just flee. This polo match, and fortunately for us, this is an example of how we tried as best we could to bring some sense of balance to it. Charles sat down for an interview right after that polo match and defended Diana, and he said, you know, it's his exact words were something along the lines of, you know, it's not much fun when you go to a polo match and you have lenses poking at you from every direction, and then the pictures are published and it says looking bored. And Charles goes on to say, I only hope that once this once we're married, this kind of intensity is going to diminish. And of course, we chose that for two reasons. One, it didn't diminish, it only got worse. And two, it was an opportunity for Charles early on to say, you know, look, I understand what she's going through and you guys need to just back off. And so there are moments like that throughout. And then once the book is published, we do have some of the royal writers who were giving interviews at the time defending Prince Charles, that he's not a cold man. Penny Junior, for example, who's written many books about Prince Charles, she talks about, you know, he's not a cold man. A lot of this is Diana in her own mind. It's not, you know, it's not true. She makes this stuff up. And by that point, Diana has, one of the remarkable things is she questions her own mental health in the tapes and her own emotional stability. And that's in there as well. You know, she recognizes her own flaws. And so by doing that, we certainly, you know, made every effort we possibly could to bring balance to what is, as you said, a one-sided story.
Absolutely.
It's very difficult.
I am not surprised to hear you say that. I mean, because I do think, given the nature of what this film is, I think it is as fair to both sides as it can possibly be. And I salute you for that. And frankly, I thank you for that. I feel like I came away from this film not only appreciating certain things about Princess Diana and her experience that I had not fully appreciated before, like the extent of her bulimia or the fact that Camilla Parker Bowles was already a presence and interference even before Princess Diana and Charles were married, and the presence of those paparazzi. I mean, I think you do a terrific job with the clips that you show us of helping us understand just the pervasive irritant that they were. I mean, and far worse than that, actually. I think one thing I did not fully appreciate until I watched your film was the way in which the story of Princess Diana was exactly the story that the British public needed at the time that it emerged. Just say a word about what was going on that was such cause for unhappiness throughout so much of Great Britain. And then what made this story the kind of fairy tale story that the British public was so hungry for?
Well, you're right on the money, and we wanted to include a lot of, kind of ancillary news of the day that was going on to put it in more perspective. But the more we put in, the more we had to cut of Diana talking, and we reached a point where, you know, a fairy tale exists in a world unto itself. So we're just going to stick with our source material because that's by far the best stuff. But what was happening in the UK at the time, there were riots in the streets, very famous riots in Brixton and other places. The country was terribly economically depressed. Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister. The Falklands War came up in the 80s. It just seemed like there was it was kind of sad, and you get some of this out of the film from people who are commenting about why they want the fairy tale wedding. It's because everybody's so depressed, you know. And the news reports talk about, you know, this is such a depressing time in the UK, and thank God Charles is marrying the idyllic princess, because now we have something to hang our hat on. Now we can say, look, there is happiness in London. There is happiness in the UK. You know, we can celebrate them. You know, this is who we are. It's our heritage. It's the King Arthur and the Land of the Round Table. You know, it continues. The story continues. And so people, you know, their lives were, in a sense, I mean, miserable in many ways at that time. The economy just was really not doing well at all. And, homelessness was on the rise. There was terrible crime. And to have the fairy tale wedding come along was just something that everyone could get behind, and everyone could say, we're British, and this is who we are, and we're a part of that.
Right. As Diana herself says at one point, England was happy because they thought that we were happy. That's something
that,
as she looked.
Everyone was happy because they thought we were happy, and you know, with the caveat in her tone of like, you know, guess what, we weren't happy at all.
Right. It's a marvelous story, and we learn so much about it, and we learn so much about who they were, who in a sense we are, and I am so glad that this film was made, and so glad that it was made as carefully as it is. It is a fascinating portrait, start to finish, of a very, very important figure in this 20th anniversary year of her death. And at the end, when you have her life dates of 1961 to 1997, I realized she was 1 year younger than I was at the time that she was experiencing all of this extraordinary pressure. And the fact that she survived it at all is real testament to who she was. Again, the film is Diana, in her own words, premiering Monday night on the National Geographic Channel. Tom Jennings, its executive producer. Tom Jennings, thank you so much, and congratulations on a superb film.
Greg, thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Monday on The Morning Show, we'll be talking about another documentary called Two Towns of Jasper. This is actually a film that first premiered in 2003, and it is about to be rebroadcast on PBS's POV. It looks at a truly horrific hate crime in Jasper, Texas, that occurred in 1998. And the two filmmakers, one black and one white, went to Jasper with two separate film crews, one black, one white, to speak with the citizens of Jasper, Texas, and to try to get an understanding of what that community was all about, especially in terms of racial relations. Fascinating film, just as timely as ever, and we'll talk about it on Monday. Tuesday, Art Sear joins us. He is an expert on many things, but especially the Korean Peninsula. So we will get his take on this frightening situation with North Korea. And Wednesday, Mary Radigan, executive chef at Sazzy B's in downtown Kenosha. She's going to be one of the participants in the upcoming Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival at